Okay, we move on. We've got to, therefore, the parable of the wheat and the tares. So, Matthew 13, verse 24. Someone like to read, please, verse 24 to 30. That'd be great, thank you. So, Matthew 13, 24 to 30. If someone like to read that, please.
Jesus presented another parable to them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while his men were sleeping, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat, and went away. But when the wheat sprouted and bore grain, then the tares became evident also. The slaves of the landowner came and said to him, 'Sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares?' And he said to them, 'An enemy has done this.' The slave said to him, 'Do you want us then to go and gather them up?' But he said, 'No, for while you are gathering up the tares, you may uproot the wheat with them. Allow both to grow together until the harvest. And in the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, first gather up the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them up, but gather the wheat into my barn.'"
Thank you very much. So you have this this man, he's sown wheat in his field. Verse 25, we're told, while he was sleeping, an enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went away. Apparently that wasn't unusual. It's a sort of rotten trick that people used to do. Tares, they look, they're weeds. And in fact, you know, commentators will even give you the Latin name for them. It's a weed. It looks quite like wheat. But it is the crop is a bad crop. I'll come back to that in a moment. So here are tares. It's a type of weed that's sown amongst the wheat. And if you look, verse 29, well, the servant says, "Do you want us to then go and sort of pull out all the tares?" And he says, "No, lest while you gather up the tares, you also uproot the wheat with them." Tares apparently have strong roots, deep roots, and if you pull them up, the wheat's going to come up with it. You can't disentangle and disassociate with them. So basically, wheat and tares have to coexist until the harvest. They look very similar. They're growing side by side all the way to harvest. But wheat is a good crop, isn't it? That's what's been sown in the field. It's a good crop. That is its nature. Wheat brings forth a good crop. That's what wheat does. Tares, by contrast, they are a bad crop. That is their nature. And if you eat tares, they produce nausea, convulsions, and if you eat enough of them, they even produce death. So only when the two crops reach maturity are they then separated. And the tares are burned and the wheat is gathered into the barn. So what does it all mean? Well, in this chapter 13, two of the parables are explained for us, and we looked at the sower last time, and the tares are also explained to us. We're going to take this parable in two bites, one bite tonight and then one bite next time. But we come to the meaning. If someone could please read verse 37 to 43 of Matthew 13.
Of the wicked one. The enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels. Therefore, as the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of this age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and those who practice lawlessness. And he will cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears to hear, let him hear."
Thank you. Yes, now, there are seven key elements, aren't there? The picture's very simple, isn't it? There's a field, it's been sown with wheat, an enemy comes along, sows it with tares. You can't remove the tares without pulling up the wheat, so let them all grow, let them come to harvest, and then separate them at harvest. Okay? And Jesus says, well, actually, this is what it all means. And he basically points out the seven key elements. The one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man, Jesus. The field is the world, the whole world. The good seed he describes as sons of the kingdom. The tares, that's the bad seed that's been sown by the enemy, are sons of the wicked one. The enemy is the devil. The harvest, when they're separated, is the end of the age. And the harvesters are the angels. So let's go through it together. I'm going to throw out questions and we'll talk about it as we go along. Okay. First question is this. Thinking about the interpretation of the parable. Who is in control of all that takes place? As you watch the wheat and the tares grow, who's in control of all of this? That's right, the Lord, the owner of the field. Verse 27, we read that the servants, did you not sow good seed in the field? How then does it have tares? They're perplexed, they're puzzled, they don't know how, they're bewildered as to how we've got to where we've got. Where have the tares come from? But the owner is not at all fazed, is he? He says, verse 28, an enemy has done this. The servant says, well, do you want us to go and gather them up? He says, no, lest while you gather up the tares, you also uproot the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. And at the time of the harvest, I will say to the reapers, first gather together the tares and bind them in bundles and burn them and gather the wheat into my barn. So it is the will of the king that wheat and tares coexist until the harvest. The will of God, that believers and unbelievers coexist until the time of the harvest. The king, the Son of Man, is in complete control. I know it's a very obvious thing to say, isn't it? I know that. But we say, well, it's a very obvious thing to say when you read it there. But of course, there is talking about what we're going through day by day and the world in which we're living in, isn't it? So if you look at the world in which you are living, it looks like the king is not in control. You might say that, mightn't you? Lots of situations where you say, well, who's in control? What's going on? What's happening? But of course, it's not how it really appears. It's not how it actually really is. Just because at times it doesn't look like the king is in control doesn't mean he's not in control. He's in perfect control of all that's taking place. Okay, second question then. How then does this parable deal with the Jewish problem? How does the parable deal with the disparity between what the Jews are expecting and actually how the coming of the kingdom is to be fulfilled? Yes. That's right. So, do you want to say a bit more, Liz? Yes. That's right. And the wicked are still in control, apparently, aren't they? So, the Jews are expecting when the kingdom of heaven to come, when they're expecting the wicked to be punished. They're expecting the Romans to be overthrown. They're expecting their country to be given back to them. Only it'll be a glorious golden age. Their borders will enlarge. All the nations will come up to worship. But they're expecting the punishment of the wicked. Well, that doesn't happen, does it? Here, believers and unbelievers are coexisting. And they'll coexist all the way. Give me a pen here. All the way to the end of the old age. They'll live side by side. All the way to the harvest. And of course, the implication also is this. If you're waiting for everything to come to harvest, what's going to happen to the wicked in this world?
They'll get worse.
They'll get And how will that feel if you're a son of the kingdom?
Well, it'll look like they were prospering.
Yeah, it looks like the wicked are getting stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger, more and more dominant in the world, won't it? Because they're coming to harvest. We'll come back to this in a minute. Okay, so the wicked flourish right up until the end. It is that way, yeah. Well, that's another parable, Ken. absolutely. The slowest of the kingdom is the parable of the mustard seed. It's the same message, isn't it? So what's the significance of verse 29 in the light of all of this? It might be. I suppose I want to read it. Sorry, I'll read it out. They say, shall we pull up the tares now? He says, no, lest while you gather up the tares, you also uproot the wheat with them.
If the tares are ripening,
yes.
So is the wheat.
Yes.
And they need to come to a measure of fullness and completion before the harvest.
Absolutely. Completely right. I'll come to that in a minute if I may, but the fact that if you pull up the tares, you're going to pull up the wheat as well, what is that saying as the believers and unbelievers live in this world? What's the implication of that?
Very close.
They're very, very close. In other words, in this world, because the field is the world, isn't it? You're going to have husbands and wives, children and parents, next door neighbours, people at school, people in the workplace, citizens of the same country. They're all going to be mixed in together, aren't they? Completely. So it's impossible to, you can't, if you start pulling up the tares, you'll be pulling up the wheat with them because there is such an intimacy in the relationships. So they're going to live together, wheat and tares, all the way to the harvest. So they're living together, as I say, sometimes as husbands and wives, parents and children, brothers and sisters, and all that goes with that, you will be expecting a world to feel like what? What's it going to be like if you're living in the world but you're a son of the kingdom? It's going to be very, very difficult, isn't it? Because you're mixed in all the time with the tares, and the tares are completely different to the wheat. So the Jews said, when the kingdom of heaven comes, it'll be the punishment of the wicked. Life will get easier. No, says Jesus, when the kingdom of heaven comes, life will actually get harder. Because you're so intermeshed with their lives. So the Jews said, well, when the kingdom of heaven comes, there won't be any wicked people to strike you on the cheek. Jesus says, when the kingdom of heaven comes, they'll strike you on the cheek and you'll have to turn the other cheek for them to strike you on that one as well. So do you see how the parable is dealing with all of this? It's saying, I'll get my right page. It's saying that believers and unbelievers are going to coexist right up until the harvest. Not just that, they coexist in the closest possible relationships. So if you're a child of the kingdom, it's going to be tensions, tribulations, heartache, difficulties, pain, grief, sorrow. It won't be the end of your troubles. Your troubles are just beginning. Because you're living in a world that's going to be hostile to the kingdom of heaven. Okay. What's the devil up to in all of this? What's his desire? What's he trying to do? Choke you? Yeah? Do you want to throw any more into that? That's right. So he's trying to, by the very closeness of the tares to the wheat, he's trying to strangle out kingdom life, isn't he? He's trying to stop you from living for the king. What else is he trying to do? He's turned the tares against the wheat, so the tares become hostile. Go on. Yeah. He's doing everything he can, isn't he, to make trouble for the sons of the kingdom. Now, every time I say sons of the kingdom, that's what Jesus says. It includes men and women, doesn't it? Because a son is an heir. You inherit it. It's not saying it's for the lads and not for the ladies. It's saying all of us have the status of sons, okay? Because all of us are heirs. So he's resisting the coming of the kingdom, and he's seeking to make trouble for the children of the kingdom, for the sons of the kingdom, and he's seeking to do it by promoting the tares, isn't he? The stronger and better the tares grow, the more difficulty and trouble it makes for the people of God. Because it means the wheat all the time is having to contend with the tares. Does that make sense? Just sort of throwing in aside, really, also. We just think about these last few weeks. Jason, there's been times of real seeking the Lord, hasn't there, about Jason? And, you know, praise God for all that's been taking place and those answers to prayer. We've been stirred up as a church to be more prayerful about things. We have different groups are praying, and God willing, as a whole church praying. I think of Bill Dyer was down last week. Men's training thing is getting underway. All sorts of things are going on, and we're going to talk more about a vision for the church and so on. So Satan hates all those things. So don't be surprised if at this particular time there are all sorts of things stirring us and troubling our walk with the Lord at a personal level, also at a church level. Don't be surprised if there are assaults on the church, discouragements coming to the church, attacks on the unity of the church, attacks on the focus of the church, all those sorts of things. Expect them. Look for them. Guard, be to be forewarned is to be forearmed, isn't it? Because all the time he's trying to resist the coming of the kingdom. And if a church is beginning to stir and move and say, right, the kingdom is our priority, then the one who's going to be acting against that is the devil, the wicked one. So he'll do everything he can to resist the progress of the kingdom. And the quicker he can get in there to stop it from happening, and much easier to resist at the beginning of things than later in things, isn't it? So let's all beware of that. Okay, now it gives a word here. It says, verse 38, that the field is the world, the good seeds are the sons of the kingdom, and the tares are the sons of the wicked one. What does that mean, sons of the wicked one? Unbelievers are sons of the wicked one. Yes.
So rather than genetically more like father, like son.
Yes. That's right. Yeah. Thanks, Pete. It's a Hebrewism as well, isn't it? If you're the son of something, that's what characterizes you. I mean, we understand that. We have it in our language, don't we? You're the son of a whatever, because that's what characterizes you. It just means that their defining characteristic, that their distinguishing mark is they're like the devil. So he promotes an environment where the wicked flourish, and he does all that he can to resist the kingdom and to make life as hard as possible for the sons of the kingdom. That's what he's doing. And that's why there are little glimpses every now and again of what the world might be like were it not for the restraining grace of God. We have little glimpses, don't we, where wickedness is unrestrained. So you get a Holocaust. You get a Rwanda. You get the killing fields in Cambodia. In those moments, it seems that Satan has a freer hand. I don't know if we can say it like that. Or there's less restraining grace. And you see the wickedness of the wicked for what it really is. And we live, don't we, day by day, without actually often really thinking about how good God is to us and how restraining is his grace. We live as wheat in a world of tares. But often we don't feel the pain of that, do we, really? And that's because of the restraining grace of God, the kindness of God. And that's why God gives us little glimpses of what happens when he takes his hand away. Interesting, in Cambodia, wasn't it? In Cambodia, there was a revival before the Killing Fields. There's a book called, someone help me please, what's it called? That's right, Killing Fields, Living Fields. I don't know if you've read that. It's very moving. Because it was a great work of God in Cambodia. Great numbers turned to the Lord. The Killing Fields then came just after that, and a lot of those who were killed were believers. So Satan, given a free hand, we could see what he can do.
Isn't that a point to note, really, as well, the chronology of it, that Satan doesn't sow any tares until good seed has been sown. He doesn't bother him to know good seed.
That's a very good point, isn't it?
What you're saying about, yes. If we're being scared, then perhaps we should expect that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Very good point. Paul?
Often, I think, when churches are planted, Paul warned that there were those who come along, who looked like wheat. But it's people saying until the church was planted, they wouldn't see them. And they infiltrate the church to look like wheat itself.
That's right. Yes, you can get Ananias and Sapphira, can't you, in the Jerusalem church, trying to ingratiate themselves. And they're exposed to being false, aren't they? That's why we're here to pray tonight, isn't it? We need to pray mindfully about these things. Okay, fourth question, which is really just gathering up some things we've been saying already. What will happen to the world if the tares are not removed until the harvest? What will we expect to happen in this world? Yeah. So what can we expect to happen? If you look at the history of the world, which way is history going to go? Yeah, things are going to get worse and worse, aren't they? That's the implication. Wickedness will intensify. Lawlessness will increase. Because the tares are going on to harvest, they're going on to a ripeness, a fullness, a completeness. So expect the world to become more and more wicked as the tares ripen. The language is of lawlessness, isn't it? Verse 41, the Son of Man will send out his angels and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and those who practice lawlessness. Now, 1 John 3, I need to turn to it, I'll just read it out. John says, 1 John 3, verse 4, whoever commits sin also commits lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. What is lawlessness? What does lawlessness mean?
Saying there is no law.
That's right, isn't it? It's if you're lawless, you don't just break the law. You say there is no law. So if you're driving through a 30 mile an hour limit, and you drive at 35 miles an hour, you've broken the law, haven't you? And if you were stopped, you might say, yeah, no, I went a bit too fast. If you drive through a 30 mile an hour limit at 110 miles an hour, your behavior is absolutely lawless, isn't it? You're saying there is no law that binds me, that I have to take any care or regard of. I can drive as fast as I like. That's lawlessness. If you park on a yellow line and get a ticket, you say, well, I thought I'd try and get away with it. But if you park on the yellow line and then you go around smashing up all the ticket machines and beat up all the traffic wardens, that's lawlessness, isn't it? You're saying, how dare they tell me where I should and shouldn't park? Okay? So lawlessness is what the tares practice. I don't just break God's law. I go against God with all my being. I drive at 110 to 30 mile an hour limit. It's a complete rejection of the lawgiver. I'm not just defying God, I reject the law in principle. Okay? In other words, what the tares do, they say, we decide what is good and what is evil. We decide what is right and what is wrong. It is not for God to tell us what to do. We do the deciding. That's what lawlessness is. So lawlessness will reach a fullness. The poisonous crop will reach a fullness. It's So therefore, brothers and sisters, don't be surprised when things happen in our nation where people are saying, we decide what is good and what is evil. We decide how this should or shouldn't be done. And we get a little glimpse of it, don't you, in the desire to redefine marriage. That's a little glimpse of the way the tares behave. No one tells us what we say. Well, you know, if enough of us agree, then we will redefine marriage. I mean, it's a creation ordinance. It's a reflection of the Godhead, marriage. It's a picture of Christ and the church. Christ is married to a virgin bride. But they come along and say, no, we will say what it is and what it isn't. And that's why when you see the boundaries being removed and there's a redefinition of these things and people choosing, it's lawlessness, but you also know that harvest is getting closer and closer. Someone sends me emails. They're sort of shock emails they keep sending me about, oh, look at this, isn't this terrible? Oh, look at that, look what they're doing now. And it's sort of, I get sort of like, it's like these sort of headline emails. And they mean well, but I sort of think, well, expect it. Don't be surprised by these things. That's what lawlessness is. It's a removing of the God-ordained boundaries. And don't be surprised in this world if the tares get their way. They'll be in the ascendancy. They'll be dominant. They'll pick and choose. Now, I'm not therefore saying, therefore, we don't do anything about it, because the whole point about, as we shall see next time, about the wheat is that they must behave like the wheat. But don't be surprised. Nothing in one sense is going wrong. We must expect the tares to flourish. The servant said, do you want us to go and gather them up? No, lest while you gather up the tares, you also uproot the wheat with them. We expect the tares to flourish. We expect them not to listen to God's people. In many ways, our values will not carry the day. Not in this world. And yet the kingdom will come. So we're not despondent and we're not pessimists. We're wonderful. We're optimistic, because the worst they get, we're getting close to harvest time. Okay. If that's what's happening to the tares, it's becoming more and more wicked. The wheat also is coming to a ripeness, isn't it? This is my fifth point, really. They're called sons of the kingdom, because that's their defining characteristic. They love the king. They obey the king. They're devoted to the king. So just as the tares will reach a fullness and a ripeness of wickedness, so also the wheat will grow into a ripeness, a fullness of kingdom life, of obedience to the king, of devotion to the king. In other words, just before the harvest, the implication is that it'll be the most Christ-like generation that's ever lived. Do you think the wheat is ripening? If you look at the history of the church, if you look at it, do you think the wheat is ripening? Or do you think they were more godly before than they are now? Or that things are better before than they are now? Yes. Okay. Well, if the field is the world, so we're taking a global picture, what do you think? Okay, so there are more believers than there have ever been, aren't there? And the gospel is more global than it's ever been. I think chatting with Palmer Robertson 2 or 3 years ago, he's American, but he's in Uganda, and he was talking about the Southern Hemisphere. Now, we live in Western Europe, don't we? Western Europe is only about 10% of... Europe, I think the European Union, the 27 nations, is something like 10% of the world's population. But we tend to think that's the world, don't we? So there's 90% outside the European Union. He said, if you go into the Southern Hemisphere, it's been an incredible explosion of the gospel in so many of these nations. Or you go to China, great numbers are being converted. We have a very small view of the world, don't we? And because it's rough over here, in one sense, well, this is not, but because there aren't many believers, we tend to sort of roll that out for the whole world. There are now more believers in more nations than there have ever been. So say it again, Ken.
It's flourishing in those countries where there is intense persecution.
That's right. So where the tares are most threatening, the gospel in many cases is flourishing. It's Iran's time at the moment, isn't it? Lots of Iranians converted outside Iran, large numbers converted inside Iran, for example. What about in terms of understanding of the Bible? Do you think we understand more today than they did centuries ago or 100 years ago? What do you think? Yes. That's right. So we have far better resources, don't we, to understand the Bible? Books, access to things. Anything else add on that? That's right. So we can all read. That's quite a new thing, isn't it? In terms of the history of the world. We're all able to read. We're able to have the Bible at home and read it. You know, when Timothy's told to give attention to reading, it's because they didn't have any Bibles. They come together on the Lord's Day to hear the Bible being read, the Scriptures being read. Well, that's something new, isn't it? The fact we've all got our own Bibles, we can read them. There's been an evolution of doctrine as well. Up until the 15th, 16th century, people thought that the kingdom of heaven would come with the state, that the kingdom of heaven and the state were coextensive. So you had state churches. That's why we've still got a Church of England. It's a state church, isn't it? In other words, you advance the kingdom of God, you advance the kingdom of heaven by passing laws, by having a parish. And then everyone inside that parish, provided they live a relatively decent life and have been baptized, they're Christians. You can Christianize the world through the arm of the state. Well, nearly every Christian believed that. But we don't believe that now, do we? Because we've understand our Bibles better. The whole argument in the Reformation about how am I right with God? Well, of course, it wasn't there were no believers up until the 16th century. There suddenly had a big load of believers at the Reformation. There were loads of believers, but an understanding of the gospel, and I'm right with God. I'm justified by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. That, as an understanding, wasn't really fully comprehended until the 16th century. Okay. Yes.
Well,
that's not to say they weren't, I mean, extraordinarily godly people all through that time, is it? Look at Augustine. The way you read his confessions, you think, I've never even thought about these things, never crossed my mind. Because the man's got enormous intellect and has affected Christian thinking for the last 1,500 or 1,600 years, hasn't he? So there are these giants that come along. Yes. But we are thinking about the field, aren't we, as the world. So we are taking a big picture. I think that's the thing to say, isn't it? So whilst we may say, well, over here and over there and over there, in terms of a global picture, it's saying that it's not saying there weren't godly people before, incredibly godly people. What we're saying is that our understanding of the Bible, our understanding of truth has actually evolved and developed over the years. It's not saying that they didn't understand; they did. But often you read the Puritans, and it always does you good. And you think these people have the experience of God that we don't have in our generation. Maybe that's our generation in Western Europe. But taking a global picture, saying that the wheat will come to harvest, so expect there to be a change in growth. The reason Athanasius stands against the world, doesn't he? Arguing for the deity of Christ. Well, that's an argument that's been won. We passed that. It's gone. It's unthinkable, isn't it, that just a handful of people have believed in the deity of Christ. Now we all accept that, of course, Christ is God. So all I'm saying is that there is a development, there is a change. Okay? Yes, yes.
For many generations to come.
And John Calvin, I'm certainly not saying these men, we love these men, these are giants and we stand on their shoulders. All we're saying is that the wheat, in a global picture, in a global perspective, is moving towards ripening. That's all I'm just trying to say. So in terms of the number of believers in the world, in terms of the extent which the gospel covers the world, in terms of our understanding as the sons of the kingdom across the world, we're moving towards harvest. That's all I'm trying to say. All right? I'm not making any disparaging remarks about any of the men. We just simply stand on their shoulders. Okay, number six then. What then are we to expect before the harvest? Nearly at an end. What are we to expect then just before harvest? What sort of world will it be? Tares ripening, wheat ripening. What would we expect to see in a world like that? Miles?
Highly polarized world.
Highly polarized world, and what else that might come on the back of that?
I'd expect conflict between the wheat and the tares vying for the same ray of sun
mm-hmm.
and water.
Mm-hmm. So you have conflict, polarization. Anyone else to throw anything else in? To destroy the church, yeah, that's right. Towards the end, what you're going to get, you're going to find wherever you look, the gospel will be found. Because the harvest is growing. So wherever you go in the world, you're going to find believers. You're going to find that the godly, because the wheat is ripening, especially to be the most godly generation of the church, universally. Lots of exceptions, I know, but universally. Wherever you find the godly, because wheat and tares, you'll find the wicked, you'll find the tares, side by side. And because the tares are coming to ripeness and harvest too, it's a poisonous crop, there will be a harvest of wickedness like there's never been. You'll have the most godly generation ever, you'll have the most wicked generation ever. And they'll be side by side. So you'll have persecution like you've never had it before. And that's why you have, you know, Revelation. You have the language that's used on Sunday evening, God willing, we'll be thinking about Armageddon. Armageddon is a great battle. Well, what's going on? Well, the world is united in opposition against the church. It comes to war against the church. You move into Revelation 19, where the same thing is spoken of again, where I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. The nations gather to destroy the church. Psalm 83, again, it speaks of their enemies all around Israel, all gathering around Israel. It's speaking in Old Testament language, but what it's talking about is all the nations turning against the church. So wherever the church is, there'll be hostility. So you have this sort of thing. So you have that's your wheat coming to harvest, okay? It's been growing, it's germinating, it's come to a fullness there. And alongside it are the tares, that's also coming to harvest. You'll have the most godly generation, you'll have the most wicked generation, they'll be side by side in each other's pockets, you'll have a persecution like there's never been. And wherever the church is, will be in the reach of persecution. So that's why all this language you get in Revelation and other places where it talks about the city of God being surrounded, Jerusalem being surrounded, the people of God being surrounded. It's not talking about a literal war, it's simply talking about the desire for the world to stamp out and destroy believers. And of course it's then that the king on his white horse rides to the rescue of his bride. And that's why you read Revelation 9. It's so thrilling, so exciting, because when she's surrounded, when the bride's surrounded, the doors of heaven are thrown open. And he rides out on a white charger at the head of his armies. And he comes to the rescue of his bride. Psalm 45, it's the same thing. He's riding. The king is riding, and he's riding on account of truth and righteousness. And his enemies fall under his sword. And he's coming to take his bride. It's the whole drama and excitement of Scripture. He's coming for his bride. That's why when Christ comes, when Christ returns, it'll be the most thrilling, wonderful moment, because the church will be hated as it's ever been, and opposed and attacked and assaulted. And yet she'll be beautiful. There'll be a ripeness. There'll be a loveliness about her, the most godly generation. And of course, all the people of God will go to meet him in the air. Okay, so it's simply saying the contrast couldn't be greater. And the nearer his coming, the greater the contrast, the more we should expect persecution and trouble. But that's not to discourage us, because it means his coming is closer. And then finally, the last thing is harvest. And the angels come and they gather the people, and the sons of the kingdom will shine, and the sons of the wicked one will burn. But just as we close, look at verse 41. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and those who practice lawlessness. Why does Jesus say they are gathered out of the kingdom? Why does he put it like that? Sorry?
It's his field.
So what's the implication of that?
The kingdom remains where it was before.
Yes.
And what doesn't belong gets removed.
Yes. So in other words, they're gathered out of the kingdom because they don't belong in the kingdom. We live in a world where the wicked treat it as though it's theirs. Don't they? And that we're the imposters. And either we conform or we get out. That's the way that we're treated, isn't it, believers? That's why they're persecuted. But actually, it's not the sons of the kingdom who are the imposters. It's the tares. It's those who live for this world. They're the imposters. They're the ones who don't belong. And therefore, they'll be pulled out. And you remember Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, "And the meek shall inherit the earth." The sons of the kingdom to whom all this belongs. That's always been his intent, to give the kingdom to his children. We're not the imposters. We don't have to censor ourselves as though we don't belong here. We do. Well, we'll stop there. We'll have a second bite next time. So, homework is just think of some applications. There are all sorts of applications to think about as we look at the parable again next time.